Chapter 2. In the depths of the Whispering Tower, a lone figure hooded in a robe of embroidered jade stood in the center of a domed chamber that echoed with the myriad voices of a departed choir. Garbled and indistinct sounds swirled around him like a corrupted vox signal or a transmission hurled across galactic space in ages past. At the dome's apex was a crystalline lattice pulsing with internal illumination that cascaded from its multi-angled facets in a waterfall of shimmering light. Evander Grigoras stood in the center of the swirling mist, his arms sweeping out like the conductor of an invisible orchestra. Hazy shapes formed around him, innumerable faces, objects and places. They surfaced in the light like phantoms, then faded into the mist, each one summoned and dismissed with a precise gesture. The voices rose and diminished, snatches of wasted words and redundant phrases that would be meaningless to anyone not trained in the art of the cryptosthesian. Grigoras sifted the bleed with the efficiency of a surgeon, discarding that which was of no importance and memorizing those items that piqued his interest. Grigoras was not a man whose company others craved. Though entirely average in appearance, he had seen the secret, ugly face of humanity, and such sights made a man melancholy of aspect. Where others might talk of love, truth, and a new golden age, Grigoras saw lust, deceit, and the same tired melodramas played out in the psychic waste of every communique that passed through the City of Sight. Never more so than now. With the treachery of the War Master and the departure of Rogal Dorn's Annihilation Fleet, the astro-telepathic choirs were operating beyond capacity to satisfy the demands of waging a distant war against this rebellion. Horus Lupercal had cast his treacherous spark into an unstable galaxy, and entire systems were declaring for his forces in wave after wave of defection. It seemed the Emperor's dream of galactic unity was slipping away day by day. Etheric space was awash with telepathic communication, and messages were being hurled into the void that screamed for help, or simply blared hatred. The trap chambers beneath the iron towers of the city were filled with psychic residue from the thousands of messages, and Grigoras's cryptosthesians could barely keep up with the brutal pace. In the face of treason, every message sent to Terra had to be carefully scrutinized, no matter how mundane it might appear. The bleed was scoured for signs of encryption that might be a communication intended for embedded agents of the War Master. Insane amounts of communication traffic was coming from the palace every day, and the City of Sight's astropaths were burning out with greater rapidity than ever before. The captains of the black ships attempted to spread their nets ever wider for emergent psychers to replace these burnouts, but the war had cut off many of the more promising systems. New astropaths arrived every week, but the Imperium's need was continually outstripping demand. Yet amongst this fresh influx, there was one addition to the Tower's roster of astro-telepaths that Grigoras believed to be a liability. He had railed against allowing Kai Zulane to return to the tower, arguing that the man should be dismissed to the Hollow Mountain. But the choirmaster had ignored his objections. Sensing Sarashina's hand in Zulane's repatriation, Grigoras had confronted her at the Obsidian Arch as she returned from another conference with the Sigillite's emissaries. Her steps were weary, but Grigoras had cared nothing for her lethargy.
"Your student returns to us, then," he had said, not bothering to disguise his venom.
She turned to him, and he felt her brief surge of irritation quickly suppressed.
"Not now, Evander," she had said. "Can I at least enter the tower before you berate me?"
"This won't wait,"
she sighed.
"Kai Zulane, Yes, he will be here within the week.
I assume you know Castana are just dumping him here to save face with the 13th Legion. If you cannot fix him, the blame falls on us, not them.
I will not need to fix him because he is not broken, Sarashina had said, walking briskly towards the tower. Everyone experiences loss and trauma at some point in their service. Grigorash shook his head.
Not like Zulane did. He and the girl should have had a bullet in the back of their heads as soon as the Space Marines found them. Voducina knows it. So does the choirmaster. But not you. Why is that?
Kai is stronger than any telepath I have ever trained, said Sarashina. He is more resilient than he knows.
But what they saw and heard
was more terrible than you or I can imagine. But they survived, and I will not condemn them for that. I believe they survive for a reason, and I would know what that reason is.
The Vatic have seen nothing to validate that belief, said Grigoras. I would know of it.
Not even you can uncover every potential, Evander.
True, but I see more than you. Enough to know that Kai Zulane should not be here.
What do you know? Asked Sarashina. What have your grubby little scavengers found that I should hear?
Nothing concrete, admitted Grigoras. But there are dark currents in the echoes of every vision we pass from the bleed. Hidden things without form or presence. I do not understand them, for they do not appear in any of my Honora Critica.
You have consulted the Alkira Mundi?
Of course. But even in Yun's collection I can find no correlation of imagery beyond the vulgar texts of pre-Unity dreamers. Demons, gods and the like.
You should know better than to give credence to the dreams of those who professed belief in the divine and the sorceries of magicians. I'm surprised at you, Evander. No more had been said, and despite his continued objections, the choirmaster had allowed Kai Zulane to return to the City of Sight. For once, Grigoras had found himself in accord with Maxim Golovko, a situation that was almost too ridiculous for words. He pushed thoughts of Kai Zulane aside as yet more psychic emanations spilled into the chamber. The aftermath of the messages sent in the wake of Abir ibn Khaldun's communion with the 10th Legion. The knowledge that Ferus Manus was racing ahead of his main fleet for personal revenge had prompted a barrage of messages from Rogal Dorn, urging caution and rigid adherence to his order of battle. But whether any would be heeded was another matter entirely. With wide sweeps of his hands and deft strokes of his fingertips, Grigoras began the process of psychic examination, hoping he might see yet another fragmentary hint of the pattern that had been his passion for over a century. Grigoras sat at the crossroads of the Imperium, where lines of communication crossed and recrossed. From here, expedition fleets were dispatched, recalled or regrouped. The fate of tens of thousands of worlds was decided within the walls of the palace, and it all passed through the City of Sight. To sift through the vast quantity of psychic debris that was left in its wake was the task of the Cryptothesians, a task few relished, but which Evander Grigoras had made his life's work. Telepaths on every world of the Imperium had been sending their thoughts to Terra for nearly two centuries. And each one had eventually come to him in this chamber. They spoke of wars, of lost branches of the species, of heroes and dastards, of loyalty and betrayal, and all the millions of trivial matters in between. He had sifted the psychic waste of millions of astro-telepaths for over 100 years, and uncovered all manner of hidden vice, greed, and sedition in the detritus of transmitted messages. He had seen the very worst of people, the dark,
petty, ridiculous, malicious subtexts hidden in a thousand different places in everything they said without ever realizing. And amid the countless dream-born messages that came to the City of Sight, Evandra Gregoras had begun to see a pattern emerge. For decades, he had studied any bleed that carried a tantalizing hint of this emergent cohesion, learning more of its brilliant complexity with every scrap he uncovered. Perhaps only one in every 100 messages would contain a veiled reference to it, then one in 1,000, 10,000. Each time, the truth of the message would be veiled in secrecy or lunacy, buried in subtextual code so subtle that few would ever recognize it as a cipher, even the senders of such messages. Through the decades, it became clear that there was a secret to the Imperium that was known only to a fragmented diaspora of madmen, who were wholly ignorant of each other's existence, yet who hurled their desperate messages into the void in the impossible hope that their warning would be heeded. Only here, in the Whispering Tower, did their disparate scraps converge, like a single song straining to be heard amid a cacophony of voices. Gregoras had not fully deciphered the truth of this song, but had come to one inescapable conclusion. It was getting louder every day. Dawn brought light, but no respite from the cold. The mountains above were achingly white with snow, but little of that lay upon the roofs of the petitioner's city. Thousands of people clustered together in such confined spaces raised the ambient temperature enough to prevent the snow from lying, but kept it cold enough to bite. Roxanne pulled her robes tighter about her body and shivered as she pushed open the sheet steel door of the temple. It squealed noisily, setting her teeth on edge, and slammed heavily behind her as she entered the echoing space given over to grief. Like most buildings in the petitioner's city, the temple had been constructed from random materials appropriated from the endless cycles of construction, repair, and rebuilding that now engulf the palace. Its walls were raised with marble offcuts, stacked and mortared by itinerant Migao, expelled from the Masonic guilds for habitual usage of narcotics. That stonework had been shaped and carved into a menagerie of forms, distraught angels with upraised arms, weeping cherubs with silver trumpets, and great birds with golden wings dipped in sorrow. Mosaics of mourners, fashioned in Egyptian pebble, looked down from brick corbels, and death masks of stillborn children stared out from painted frescoes assembled from crushed glass. A mishmash of pew-like benches filled the temple, many occupied by wailing families gathered round the body of a loved one. Sometimes these bodies were old. Mostly they were not. Roxanne kept her head bowed as people looked up at the sound of the door slamming. She was known here, but not known enough for people to want to speak to her, which was just how she liked it. Someone like her would attract attention, and that was the last thing she wanted. At the far end of the temple was its crowning glory, a tall statue of dark hue that had come to be known as the Vacant Angel. Thanks to some imperfection in the Syrian nephrite, the war masons had rejected the base material and cast it on the spoil heaps. Like most things discarded by the palace, it had found its way to the petitioner's city. Carved in the form of a kneeling man, its muscular body was classically proportioned and in need of finishing. The face was blank, no doubt intended to be completed in the likeness of some imperial hero by a Masonic sculptor. It had stood in the temple for over a year, but Paladis had, for reasons he kept to himself, chosen not to give it a face, though Roxanne could never shake the feeling it was looking at her with eyes just waiting to be carved. Compared to the chambers in which Roxanne had spent her youth, The temple's ornamentation was crude and unsophisticated, yet the grieving statues possessed a grace that far surpassed anything she had grown up around. What made it all the more incredible was that it was all the work of one man. Paladis Novandio stood beside Maya, who knelt weeping at the feet of the vacant angel. She cradled an unmoving infant close to her breast, as though expecting to suckle it once again. Maya's tears fell on the child's eyes and rolled down its cold cheeks. Paladis looked up and gave Roxanne a nod of welcome as she took a seat to one side of the nave. She sat within sight of the Imperium's secular heart, and yet here she was, in a temple. The thought made her smile, as precious little else had done since she had returned to Terra in disgrace. A stoop-shouldered man touched her arm, and Roxanne jumped. She hadn't heard him approach. He stood next to her, his face draped with the emptiness of loss.
"Who have you lost?"
he asked.
"No one," she replied. "At least no one recently. You?"
"My youngest sons," said the man. "That's my wife at the statue."
"You are Esteban?"
The man nodded.
"I'm so sorry for your loss," she said.
The man shrugged as though the matter were of no consequence.
"Maybe better this way."
Before Roxanne could ask him what he meant, Esteban handed her a folded sheaf of papers and made his way down the nave. He limped over to Maya and lightly took her by the shoulder. She shook her head, but her husband bent to whisper in her ear, and her wails took on a new pitch of misery as she put down her dead son. Esteban led her away from the statue, and Roxanne bowed her head as they passed, ostensibly leaving them to their sorrow, but secretly fearing their grief and ill fortune might be contagious. She looked up in time to see Paladis taking a seat in the pew in front of her. She gave him a weak smile.
"Did you get the medicine?"
he asked without preamble. She nodded.
"Yes, though it took a while to rouse Antioch from a quash stupor."
"The man likes to sample his own wares,"
said Paladis, shaking his head.
"Foolish."
"Here," said Roxanne, handing over a cloth bag the size of her fist. "It should be enough for both children."
Paladis took the medicine and nodded. His hands were rough and calloused, the nails permanently edged in black from long years working stone with rasp and chisel. He was a man of middling years, with greying hair and a face weathered like the side of a cliff from a lifetime spent in the open air, carving statues, columns, and detailed adornments for pediments and vaulted arches.
"Maya will be grateful to you,"
said Paladis,
"once she has finished her mourning."
"You paid for it. I just went to get it."
"At no small risk to your person,"
pointed out Paladis.
"You encountered no problems?"
She lowered her head, knowing she had to tell him what had happened, but fearing his disappointment more than any censure.
"Roxanne?"
he said when she didn't answer.
"I ran into some of Babu Dakhal's men,"
she said at last.
"I see,"
said Paladis.
"What happened?"
"They attacked me. I killed them."
He sighed.
"How?"
"How do you think?"
Paladis raised a placatory hand.
"Did anyone see you?"
"I don't know. Probably," said Roxanne. "I didn't mean to kill them, not at first, but they'd have cut my throat as soon as they were done with me."
"I know. But you must be more careful,"
said Paladis.
"The Babu is a man of great rages, and he will find out what happened to his men. He will come here. That much is certain."
"I'm so sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to bring you trouble. That's all I ever seem to do."
Paladis laced his big, calloused hands in her fingers and gave a slow smile.
"One problem at a time, Roxanne," he said. "Let tomorrow look after itself. Today, we are alive,
and have medicine to give two children a chance to see another dawn. If you learn anything in your time here, let it be that death surrounds us in all its myriad forms, just waiting to catch you unawares. Bend all your efforts to keeping it at bay. Honour death in all its forms. Appease it, and you will be spared its cruel attentions for a time.
He spoke with the passion of a zealot, yet there was kindness in his eyes. Roxanne knew little of his past, save that he had once been a master craftsman under the suzerainty of war mason Vadok Singh. That he had suffered loss was obvious, but he had never spoken of what had driven him to raise a temple from the ashes and debris of the petitioner's city. Roxanne bowed her head. She knew all too well how easily death could reach out and completely change the course of a life, even one spared its attention.
"What did Esteban give you?"
asked Paladis. She looked at the papers as though seeing them for the first time. The paper was thin and looked like whatever was printed on it now wasn't the first ink it had known.
"The usual,"
she said, flicking through the palimpsest and picking out phrases at random. She read them aloud.
"The Emperor of Mankind is the light and the way, and all his actions are for the benefit of mankind, which is his people. The Emperor is God, and God is the Emperor. So it is taught in the Lectio Divinitatis, and above all things, the Emperor will protect."
"Let me see that," said Paladis, with a sharpness she had not heard in his voice before. She held out the pamphlet, and he snatched it from her hand.
"Not this Lectio Divinitatis nonsense again,"
he said with a sneer of contempt before ripping the pamphlet in two.
"A bunch of desperate people beguiled by a glittering light, and who have yet to discover that all that glitters is not gold."
"They're harmless enough," said Roxanne with a shrug. "It's comforting, even."
"Nonsense," snapped Paladis. "It's dangerous, self-delusion, and I hear they've even spread these fantasies off-world. This is the very worst kind of lie, for it comforts people with a hope of protection that does not exist."
"I'm sorry," said Roxanne. "He just gave me it. I didn't ask him to."
Paladis was immediately contrite.
"Yes, of course, I'm sorry. I know that, but I don't want you reading anything like this. There is only one truth, and that is the finality of death. This is the worst kind of lie, because let me tell you, the Emperor most assuredly does not protect."
Kai had heard a wise man say that you can never go home, and until now he had never understood the sense of that. Born to a wealthy family of the American hinterlands, Kai had travelled extensively with his father, a cartel agent who brokered trade contracts between Terran conglomerates and the surviving mercantile interests of newly compliant worlds. As a youngster, Kai had scaled the heights of the mid-Atlantic ridges, explored the majestic ruins of Caligan's cities of Ursh, bathed in the glow of the Pan-Pacific magma vents, and descended into the Mariana Canyon to gaze in awe at the great cliff sculptures carved by geological artists of a forgotten age. He had spent much of each year travelling the globe, following his father from negotiation to negotiation. Life had been one adventure after another. But no matter how exhilarating each trip was, Kai would always relish the sight of the family home, perched high on the cliffs of what had once been a carven monument to long-dead kings of antiquity. His mother would be there with a welcoming smile that was just a little bit sad, because she knew it wouldn't be long until her husband and son would be travelling again. Home was more than just a physical place. It was a state of mind, and even after he had come of age and the men of the black ships had come for him, he always longed to return home to see that sad, welcoming smile. The City of Sight had become his home, but it was one to which Kai had never wanted to return. The interior of the tower was lightless, cold, and high-ceilinged, but Kai's augmetic implants compensated for the low light, and his surroundings swam into focus with a lambent green glow. It wasn't that the builders had set out to make the tower inhospitable. It was more the purpose it had been put to, and the mien of its inhabitants that coloured it so. Kai imagined that with the gilt-edged hangings and dazzling lights that illuminated every other structure in the palace, the Whispering Tower could be just as impressive. The stonework of its walls tapered inwards, plain smooth and cut with mason's marks that helped the newly blind discern their location. Here and there, an inset whisper stone glinted in the dim light, and Kai wondered what secrets they pass between each other in such troubled times. Kai followed Sarashina along the narrowing chamber towards a curved wall, machine smooth and silver, incongruously modern amidst the ancient stone. Two black sentinels stood guard before a sigh-sealed doorway in the silver wall, and they stood aside as Golovko waved a data wand before them. Kai watched the glowing hash of code ciphers reflected in the visors of the soldiers, automatically storing the binaric information before it faded. The door slid open, and a cold gust of air sighed from within. Kai shivered as the psychically charged air caressed the skin of his face. Inside the silver chamber was a grav lift, shaped in the form of a double helix that ran the full length of the tower. A nimbus of light surrounded the gravity field, and Kai's augmetics picked out the differing waveforms that rippled up and down the shimmering cascade. Around the outer walls of this silver chamber, sealed doors led into iron-clad mind halls, where choirs of astropaths distilled messages sent from all across the galaxy, while others led to vaulted libraries filled with arcana, gathered from the distant corners of Terra.
"We are going to the novitiate's level," said Sarashina,
stepping into the leftmost curve of the double helix. The grav lift enfolded her in its gentle embrace and carried her with smooth grace down into the tower. Kai hesitated at the edge of the light, knowing that once he took this step, there would be no going back.
"Hurry up, Zulin," said Golovko. "I have better things to do than babysit you."
"I seriously doubt that,"
said Kai, stepping into the light. Any step was a good one if it carried him away from Golovko. The light surrounded Kai and carried him into the tower. He travelled down the spiral, turned around as he descended into the bowels of his former abode. He passed numerous jutting steps where he could have stepped from the grav lift, but Sarashina had said they were going to the novitiate's level, and that was right at the bottom of the Whispering Tower. At last, Kai felt the reassuring feel of solid ground beneath him and stepped out of the light. His eyes adjusted immediately to the brightly lit surroundings. Not everyone who navigated these passages was blind, and bare lumen globes hung from the brickwork ceiling on linked loops of brass cabling. This chamber had been hacked from the bedrock of the mountains and faced with ceramic tiles of bottle green. It had the feel of a Medicaid chamber, and a number of locked doors led deeper into the guts of the tower. Some led to the novice libraries, where new additions to the tower learned astropathic shorthand, common symbols, and the basic mantras of the nuncio. Others led to the novice's cells, yet more to communal facilities for eating and ablutions, while yet others ended in hermetically sealed isolation chambers. In the moments before Golovko and his sentinels arrived, Kai took a moment to study his former mentor. Anik Sarashina had aged since Kai had seen her last, and the naked light from the lumens was unflattering. Her hair had lost the last of its blonde luster, and was now completely silver. Puckered lines radiating from the plastic hemispheres inserted into her eye sockets had grown deeper and more pronounced. She had been old when Kai had last been here, but now looked positively ancient.
"Do I look so different?"
asked Sarashina, and Kai blushed at being caught in his frank appraisal of her appearance.
You look older, he said at last.
I am older, Kai, said Sarashina. I have travelled the warp for too many years, and it has left its mark upon me.
She reached up and ran her fingers over the rumpled skin of his face, her touch feather-light and tender.
As it has on you, too.
The curse of the astropath was premature aging, and Kai didn't need Sarashina to tell him that he had lost the clean lines of his high cheekbones and his growth of fine salt-and-pepper hair. Though he was in his late 30s, he had the appearance of a man in his 50s, at least. The face that looked back at him in the mirror, on those days he could face his reflection, was gaunt and hollow, with pinched cheeks and sunken eyes. Only the most expensive Juvenat treatments could conceal the damage constant warp travel wreaked on a human being, and no astropath, even one of House Castana, was worth that indulgence of vanity. Kai backed away from her touch.
I never thought I would return here, he said,
anxious to change the subject.
Few of us ever do, agreed Sarashina.
Should I be honoured at being one of those few?
That depends on how you view your return.
As a punishment, said Kai. What other way is there to interpret it?
I will leave you to ponder that question for now, said Sarashina,
as Skolovko stepped from the grav lift. His black sentinels swiftly followed, and when they were all assembled, Sarashina unlocked the door to her immediate left. Kai frowned at this new direction.
I am not a novice, he said. This route leads to the training hall set aside for initiates of the Nuncio.
It does indeed, Kai, agreed Sarashina. Where else would your training begin?
Begin? I've served the Telepathica for over a decade, and I know the rites of incubation. I don't need to be treated like a child.
We'll treat you how we damn well please,
snapped Golovko, pushing him towards the open door.
You don't have any say in the matter, and if it was up to me, I'd never have allowed you back. You're dangerous. I can feel it.
You should watch those feelings, Golovko,
said Kai, shrugging off the man's grip.
Things like that will get the Psi-hounds sniffing around you, and I don't think you've got what it takes to cut it here.
Enough, both of you, said Sarashina. Your petty posturing is ridiculous and will only cause tremors in the ether.
Kai said nothing, knowing she was right and remembering the low-grade irritation he'd felt whenever outsiders had let their emotions get the better of them in close proximity to a whisperstone. Without further protest, Kai followed Sarashina along the passageway, the brickwork faced with tiles of ochre ceramic and the glow of the entrance hall fading behind them. Reinforced doors punctuated its length, each one marked with a number and name. Within each marked cell, an initiate of the Scholastica Psychana slumbered, perhaps dreaming, perhaps not. With the psi-shielded doors, it was impossible to know for sure. The darkness soon became absolute, yet Kai could still see perfectly well.
You are not using your blind sight, said Sarashina,
with a slight incline of her head. Kai thought he detected a hint of disappointment in her tone.
No. My augmetics allow me to see perfectly well in the darkness.
I know that. But what need of them did you have?
I didn't like being blind. Properly blind, I mean. I missed reading.
There are books for those without eyes.
I know. But I prefer to let the words come to me, said Kai. There is more to the written word than lifting the words from the page with my fingertips. Language has visual beauty that touch script can never match.
I would debate that with you. But that is a discussion for late at night, with a good book between us and a pot of hot caffeine. Could it be that you wished eyes again to hold on to some aspect of your life before entering the Telepathica?
I don't know, said Kai. Maybe. I don't see how it's important.
It may be crucial to understanding why you can no longer master the Nuncio and open yourself to the dreams of your brothers.
I know the Nuncio, said Kai defensively. I mastered it within a year.
Then why are you here? Why does House Castana send its preeminent astropath back to the City of Sight?
Kai did not answer her, and she stopped beside the open door of a cell.
I am here to help you, Kai, said Sarashina. You were my greatest student, and if you have failed, then I have failed.
No, said Kai. It's not that. It's just what happened on the Argo.
Sarashina raised a hand to stop him.
Do not speak of it here while others are abed, she said,
gesturing to the rows of cells that lined the corridor.
Sleep. Meditate for a while, if it helps you. Refresh yourself, and I will speak to you in the morning.
Kai nodded. Though his thoughts ran amok, his body craved sleep, and no matter that the bed of a novice was far from comfortable, it would be welcome. He stepped into the cell, catching a ghostly susurration of a distant voice in the darkness as he crossed the threshold. A whisper stone glinted on each side of the doorway, and he wondered into whose dream or memory he had briefly intruded. Memories were all too common in the walls of the City of Sight, and most of them were ones you wouldn't want. No one dwelled too long on memories if they valued their sanity. Kai knew that better than anyone. The door to Kai's cell closed with a heavy thud of wood on stone. There was no click of a lock, as was common for novice cells, but he could sense the presence of two black sentinels outside. Sarashina might talk to him like a prodigal son, but Golovko was another matter entirely. Kai could only imagine the nightmares Golovko's bilious presence was provoking among the true novices. His travel trunk hadn't yet made it to his cell, and he supposed the black sentinels were examining his personal effects for any hint of something dangerous. They wouldn't find anything. Kai had wanted nothing from the Argo, and his possessions amounted to little more than a few undershirts, his hygiene kit, a finely tailored suit from the seamstress houses of the Nihon Peninsula, and, of course, his many leather-bound honora critica. The books would mean nothing to the Black Sentinels, but the Cryptosthesians would examine them thoroughly to ensure there was no latent symbolism that was cause for alarm. They wouldn't find anything, but he understood they had to check. The interior of the cell was bare and devoid of anything that might have indicated who had lived here before him. That was sensible, for any lingering sense of a previous occupant would influence Kai's dreaming. A cot bed lay along one wall with a simple footlocker at its base. A small writing desk and chair sat opposite the bed, and a black notebook lay on a blotting pad next to an inkhorn and pen. Empty shelves lined the wall above the desk, ready to be filled with an astropath's steadily growing honora critica collection. The shelves were short, for a novice would take time to build a comprehensive library of imagery, symbolism, and dream recordings. Kai placed the bottle of Amasek he'd taken from the Castana skimmer on the table and lifted the notebook from the desk. He idly fanned its thick pages, smelling the crisp newness of the paper. Each page was blank, ready to be filled with dream perceptions, and he carefully placed the book down. It was empty, but the potential of what might fill its pages was like a loaded gun. Given his level of expertise, Kai wanted to feel offended at being put in a novice's cell, but the anger wouldn't come. It made sense, and he realized the lack of responsibility it implied was refreshing. He lay back on the bed and closed his eyes, letting his breathing slow as the ache of sigh sickness gnawed at his bones. Though his thoughts were troubled, sleep was a state few astropaths had trouble attaining. With the right mantras and incubation techniques, Any state of mind was possible. Sleep came easily to Kai, but his dreams were not restful.